The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Is the mitzvah to not withhold salt from the korbanos?
That's 118.
I'm sorry?
118.
To not withhold salt from the korbanos. That means you are not allowed to bring any korban without salt. The basic idea is that the sacrifices that were brought for idols, for whatever reason, the sacrifices that were brought for idol worship were brought without salt. And as usual, we attempt to try to stay as far away from any imitation of idol worship. So the Torah prohibits bringing a sacrifice without the salt being put on the sacrifice. Now, on a basic level, there's the idea that if you do something and you bring the korban without the salt, that means you're bringing it very plain. It's very plain and ordinary, and there is some type of implied deficiency in it. It's simply not an honorable sacrifice if the sacrifice lacks the salt, right? That's the basic idea of the mitzvah. The salt is always referred to in the Torah as a covenant, right? If you notice, the Torah even uses, under certain circumstances, refers to something as a bris melach, where God promises something, and it's promised as definitely as a covenant of salt. And now, why is the salt the substance that's the classic example of covenant? That means where a promise has been made. God's made a promise to the people, and he says that this promise is called a bris melach, right? It's a covenant of salt. Right, why is the covenant so? Why do they make a covenant? I'm sorry. I can't think of one. There's one with the Kohanim, right? I can't think of one offhand word. But the Torah specifically words it as a bris melach, right? Why do you think the Torah words it as a bris melach? Why is the covenant of salt? What's unique about salt? Right? Salt. Any idea? What's unique about salt?
Oh, I would say that it gets. Exactly.
What? Salt serves as a preservative. Right? Salt is a preservative. Salt never goes stale. You never hear anybody at the table say, "Do me a favor, could you get me some different salt? The salt is stale." Right? Never. It's never happened to you that you've had salt and the salt was stale. Salt itself is a preservative. Salt preserves other things. That means salt is perpetually enduring as opposed to going off, becoming stale and useless. The covenant, when God promises a covenant with the Jewish people, when the covenant is sealed, that means it's a permanent covenant. It's an eternal covenant, and that covenant is never going to go off. When you bring a sacrifice, the sacrifice of the word korban, we know the word korban, the root of the word is what? Karov. Right? The root of the word korban is karov, to draw near. It's some symbolism in a korban of the nearness of God and the Jewish people. Therefore, there is a bond, the eternal bond between God and the Jewish people is symbolized by that salt which is brought on the sacrifices, which is binding God to the Jewish people. Now, it's a much deeper idea. That's all on the surface. The deeper idea is as follows. Where does salt come from?
Sea.
Salt comes from the sea. Right? Now, you know there's a book that was written by Rabbi Kushner. Right? The name of the book was Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Right? I'm sure you've heard of the book. Rabbi Kushner, he is what's that other movement called? Reconstructionist, something like that, or some type of imaginative form of Judaism. And in this book, he contends, why do bad things happen to good people? So first of all, the basic premise of the book is a fallacy, because his basic premise is that certain people are good people. Right. Well, the one who decides whether we're good people or not is God. And how do you know what determines a good people? Right. Well, since I'm a good person, I've never hurt anybody, therefore I'm a good person. Well, that may be how we decide how somebody's a good person. Right. If I neglected to give charity today, maybe I'm not such a good people. Right? Maybe if I neglected to put on tefillin today, I'm not such a good people. Maybe if I spoke Lashon Hara today, I'm not such a good people. And in God's ultimate plan, who knows how God punishes for various sins? It's not even the word punish. The word punish is not actually accurate. The accurate word is really
the direct consequences of our actions, right? That's his first, the first mistake. The first mistake is determining that, A, defining good people, the good people are being defined by stuff, B, claiming that certain people are good people. How do you know that he's a good people? You don't know everything he's done in his life, right? How can you say somebody's a good people? You don't know what he did 20 years, maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, he killed somebody, right? Maybe 20 years ago, you see, oh, look at this poor old widow. Right, and she's suffering, so why should she suffer? You don't know what she was doing when she was. She may have been the most immoral person on her campus 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So you don't know what kind of punishment, what kind of lifetime, what kind of accumulation of sin that she has to her credit. So we can never make such a judgment. That's all based on our standards of what's a good person. Right? And certainly we can't make such a judgment if we don't know what God's standards of a good person are. Right? Now, in the book, he contends that... And remember, I'm not judging the man himself. The man himself suffered a terrible personal tragedy. He had a child with a disease, a debilitating disease, where the child ages rapidly. Right? The child ages rapidly, and eventually the child died. Right? There's some funny name for it, where it's a very, very rare disease, but the child shows all the symptoms of old age. It's like the clock's been speeded up. Right? It's like one of these movies where the rocket ship goes to the outer space, comes back, and the guy's 100 years older. Right, after being away 24 hours, right, because of the time war. So that was what happened to him. Now, obviously, he was grief-stricken, and that's what influenced him. But what's important here is what he says in the book is that there are certain, the basic premise of the book is that there are certain influences of evil in the world which are beyond God's control. God controls all the good in the world, but there are certain forces of evil which operate independently of God. And that contention is a basic contradiction to the fundamentals of Torah, right? That's what we call apikorsis. It's out-and-out heresy, right? To say that there's anything beyond God's control is out-and-out heresy because God controls everything. Now, he created a world. If you read Derech Hashem, the way of God, so you'll see that God created a world. He created worlds within this world where there are certain influences which come from God, the angels, to other influences down to man, and certain angels have certain powers that God controls. This angel controls this, and this angel controls this. But all this is within the framework of what God's given it. None of it operates independently of God. Salt comes from the sea. Right? Now, what happens? What is another character? Salt. The source of salt is water. Right? What happens when you put salt on something? You leave it for a while. What does it do?
It brings the water out of it.
What does salt itself do? What if you would leave salt on your skin for a long time? What would happen?
It would burn it.
Right. Put salt in the eyes. We always talk about salt burning. Right. We use this as burning, and salt indeed could cause burns. You leave salt on some type of surface for a long enough time, it'll burn a hole through it. Right? Salt contains water. We always talk about, if you had to think of, ask anybody, diametrically opposed forces or diametrically opposed substances, the first thing that comes to mind is fire and water. Right? Either night and day or fire and water. Right? So fire and water are the ultimate poles, the extremes of opposites, right? Yet they're both contained in salt. And that salt goes on every single sacrifice in the base of Mikdash to symbolize that God controls the extremes. That there is nothing beyond God's control. God controls the extremes all the way on the good. He controls the extremes all the way on the side of what we call bad, evil. Right? All negative forces, all positive forces, all come from God. That's what's contained in the salt. And that's the idea of having the salt on the sacrifices in the base of Mikdash. So that's number 118. Yeah.
Can I
ask? Sure, go ahead.
Things that happen bad are all conscious, acts of God. They're not
absolutely. Absolutely. Remember, everything God created in the world, every force has a counterforce. There's got to be an equal opposite. There's got to be a potential opposite, right? If there's light, there's darkness. If there's good, there's evil. If there's purity, there's impurity. Everything has the counterforce, right? God created it, right? We don't see necessarily why he acts certain ways, why bring certain influences, but it's a basic fundamental that he controls it all.
So there's nothing random for chance?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Not only that, not only is nothing random for chance, we spoke about this several times. This is important. This is what I consider one of the most important basic principles of serving God, right? Especially for somebody who's newly initiated. Right, but it's also for somebody who's been involved in this racket for a while. It's important to know, at the beginning of the year, right, when we talk about suffering, right, let's say we're men of faith, right, so we believe that we suffer. God brings us to suffering, right? How do you sue suffering, right? So, well, God decreed that a certain person is supposed to get sick. Somebody's supposed to get the flu, right? So here's a guy lying in bed. He's got a headache, and he's got fever, and he's sneezing, and it's irritating, right? And he can't taste his food. These are all forms of suffering, right? Now, what did God determine? Did God determine that this guy should get the flu, and then he just kind of sets him loose? Right? He's got the flu. God has turned him loose. Or does God determine within that flu that this person has? Right? He's going to sneeze three times. He's going to sneeze twice. He's going to have a headache. It's going to be this intensity of headache, and so on and so forth. So much so that at the beginning of the year, God determines how much suffering each individual has to go through. And the suffering is not brought randomly. The suffering could either be a result of our avarice. That means God could bring us suffering as a form of atonement. God could bring us suffering as a form of punishment. God could bring us suffering as a test. All of the suffering is determined at the beginning of the year. Now, let's just say, for example, God determines at the beginning of the year that a person has 100 suffering points that he's going to have to go through this year. Right? So a lost wallet is 5 points. Right? And a root canal is 10. Right? So each person has his own way of accumulating. You're going to have to accumulate these points. All of it is precisely measured. It's not just like, okay, this guy's going to get suffering. Okay, you're on your own now. We're turning you loose. It doesn't work that way at all. Every ounce of suffering, the Gemara says, if you reach your hand in your pocket to pull out 3 coins, only pull out 2 coins, you have to reach your hand in your pocket again, it's a form of suffering. That's a form of suffering. Right? And it's... I'm sorry? It's a good form of suffering, right. But then again, that's not the only suffering there is, right? But it has a good form of suffering. You should know, by the way, that in life experience shows, I'm sure you know this on your own, the life experience shows that in every joyous occasion, there's a medrash that God says to the Jewish people. It's a medrash. God says to the Jewish people, my suffering, and my joy is not complete, therefore your joy will not be complete either. My joy is not complete, therefore your joy will not be complete either. There are several stories the Medrash mentions about occasions that were supposed to be joyous occasions, they ended up as tragedies. And if you stop and think, every wedding you have ever been at, every wedding, every bar mitzvah, every circumcision, every simcha, every joyous occasion always ends up with a certain amount of aggravation. There is no perfectly joyous occasion. Right? At every wedding there's a fight. You were supposed to pay to cater. You were supposed to cater, didn't show up. Somebody was late. At a bar mitzvah, the rabbi charging money. The speech was boring. Who knows what went wrong? A photographer never showed up. There's always something going wrong, right? That suffering is precisely measured. None of it operates randomly. Nothing operates randomly. It's all measured to the nth degree. The reason I say it's an important fundamental is because the same way that you're meant to have 100 suffering points in the course of a year, you could remove some of those suffering points by doing mitzvahs. And that means if God says a person is supposed to get, he's going to have 5 root canals this year at 10 points apiece, right? So that's 50 points just on root canals alone. And on one of them, the Novocaine is going to wear off in the middle, right? So that's a big 15-point bonus, right? So that's what God's supposed to, he's supposed to get a certain amount of suffering points, right? Now, instead of doing that, the guy decides one morning he's feeling righteous, he's going to get up and go to Minyan. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, on a cold Yerushalayim winter morning, where you see the vapor coming out of your mouth when you wake up, you will experience this very soon. We're getting to those months. You wake up in the morning, and you will see the vapor. It's like, great, and nothing is spiritual. And you wake up in the morning, and you feel that, and then you much rather just flip over and go to sleep and try it again the next morning, and instead of that, you haul yourself out of bed and go to shul. That's a form of suffering. Right? There's a form of suffering there, right? That suffering removes other suffering of what you would call the difficult type of suffering, right? You see an old lady on the street and you help her with her packages, assuming she wants to be helped, and you help her with her packages, and you carry her packages for her, that removes suffering somewhere else, right? That means in theory, a person has the option of having root canals or putting on his tefillin in the morning. Right? In theory, getting up and putting on your tefillin in a very practical way could remove the root canals. That doesn't mean that just because you've done mitzvahs and you've done difficult mitzvahs doesn't mean you automatically remove all suffering. It could be if you wouldn't have done the mitzvahs, you would have 5 times as many root canals. Right? So you can never say, well, how come I did mitzvahs and anyway I'm suffering? It doesn't mean you can remove all of the suffering. But whatever you do, because of the precision, what you're asking, is it precise? Because it's so precise, so any effort that you exert in fulfilling God's will somewhere else, and it's an effort that took your energy and it was difficult for you, you have removed suffering somewhere else. Right? That's a fundamental principle. Okay, so in general, a person should know that nothing is wasted. Nothing you do is wasted, and that's the idea. So that's the eternal covenant between God and the Jewish people, and that's symbolized by the soul. Okay, any other questions on that? Okay, that's 118. 119 is now, yeah.
So the mitzvah
is that in the base of Mikdash, they should not bring a sacrifice without salt. That is officially the mitzvah. Do not bring a salt. The mitzvah number 119, let's hear your reaction to this. Mitzvah number 119 is you must put salt on all the sacrifices. You must put salt on all the sacrifices. Mitzvah 118 is you must not refrain from putting salt on the sacrifices. And Mitzvah 119 is you must put salt on all the sacrifices. Right? Any problem there? Seems to be repeating itself. Seems to be a little repetitive. All right, so here you have a phenomenon of two commands on one mitzvah. You'll notice that the two commands are, one is a negative command, one is a positive command. There's a negative command to not withhold salt, and the positive command to put the salt on the sacrifice. That means the command is coming at you from two directions. The practical, what practical difference does it make? What practical difference it makes is that if a person neglects this command, he has transgressed two averas. Right? That means he gets nailed, he gets double jeopardy here. Right? So there is a double command on the mitzvah, which also emphasizes the importance of the mitzvah. But you'll find this in the Torah and other areas where you have both a positive command and a negative command on one particular mitzvah in the Torah. Yeah.
Is there any way to read that commandment right now?
Nowadays, nowadays the closest we get to salt, you know the idea of we have salt on the table. Every time we eat a meal, we have salt on the table. We dip our bread in the salt. Right? So here there are several ideas. First of all, the idea is that our table, because we don't have an altar we no longer have the base of Mikdash, and we no longer have the altar in the base of Mikdash, our table represents the altar in the base of Mikdash. That's why whatever we do at the table determines whether we have an altar in our home or we've got a table that is used for hedonistic purposes. Right? What is our purpose for eating? Right? Do we live to eat? Or do we eat to live? Right? That's ultimately the question. The table, that if we turn our table into an altar, you know that in Pirkei Avot it says that any table where there has not been a word of Torah spoken, right? Three people are sitting at a table and eating. If they do not exchange a word of Torah at the table, so it is as if their table is a place of zivchei mesim. Zivchei mesim means sacrifices. Friends of the dead is an acronym. It's a metaphor for idol worship. That means it's as if they have brought sacrifices to the idols. If they've sat at a table, three people have sat at a table, not exchanged a word of Torah, so then it's as if they brought it. And what about two people? Two people are sitting at a table is okay. Right? Two people don't have to speak Torah. Only three people. If three people are sitting at a table and don't say Torah, then it's as if they've offered a sacrifice to the idols. What about two people? Two people don't have to. Hey, great, right? We're off today, right? We'll sit together. We don't have to. Don't have to speak any Torah. We're off. What's the idea? What's Pirkei Avot trying to tell us, right? What's the difference between when three people eat together and two people eat together? Three people is indicative of having a little more time on your hands, right? Two people get together. You know, you catch a quick meal and you gotta run. Three people sitting together and eating is already it's a happening. Right? You have three people are sitting down, that means they've got some time on their hands. So two people, we could understand, two people eating, not saying a word to each other, especially if they're husband and wife, two people eating, not saying a word to each other, and then scattering, right? They have things to do, they have to go run wherever it is they have to be. Three people eating together, that means it's already an occasion where people have time on their hands. So you get together and three people are in a rush, the same thing would apply. If they're obviously in a rush and they don't have time, so just eat and go. But the idea is that if three people are eating together, obviously they're in a situation where they've got time on their hands. So if you have time on your hands and you're eating and you don't mention, so you're going to be sitting at a table. Most people are sitting at a table conversing over your food. And you don't do any talking at all, or you do talking. You speak about all sorts of politics and sports, art, whatever you talk about. Yet you don't mention any Torah. That meaning has no connection to Torah, which means your eating has no connection to any purpose in life. Your eating is an ends in and of itself. That is ultimately a sacrifice to the idols. That's a form of idol worship. That means you don't believe there's any purpose to life. Yet if you eat and you speak Torah at the table, you're demonstrating that your eating is a way of fulfilling God's will. Do you know that if we eat with proper motivation or we sleep with proper motivation, we get credited for that as if we're doing a mitzvah? Do you know that if you go to sleep at night, and it's a good thing to practice, right? If your idea when you go to sleep at night is that I'm going to sleep to refresh myself so that I could do my service to God better tomorrow, I need to rest so that I can clear my head so I can study Torah better the next day. So I'll be in a better mood. I won't snap at people the next day. I won't get angry the next day. Whatever reason I need to go to sleep, if that's what your motivation is, if that's what you think about when you go to sleep, the entire duration of time that you're sleeping is credited to you as if you've done a mitzvah. For every moment that you're asleep, it's as if you're doing a mitzvah, you're serving God. Question?
Yes, I have sort of a general question, since it's my first time in Israel lecture.
Okay.
And it's this. You said two things just now. One is you get credit as if you were doing a mitzvah. So it's not actually a mitzvah to go to sleep at the right or to
Well, it's the type of thing that could go in two directions.
Does mitzvah, the word mitzvah, only count for the 613 things?
Mitzvah is...
I hear people, like a father says to a child, here, take this cup of water over to the guest over there, and you're doing a mitzvah. Is that one of the 613, or is it...
Oh, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. Taking a cup of water, that's a very good example. Taking a cup of the water is not one of the... Nowhere in the Torah does it say you must take a cup of water to your guests, right? It doesn't say that. And nowhere in the Torah does it say you must sleep with proper intent. However, everything you do, the 613 mitzvahs, almost everything you do will fall into one of the categories of the mitzvahs. Taking water to a guest falls into the mitzvah of v'halachta bidrachav. You must follow God's path. Right? The same way that God is merciful, you have to be merciful also. The same way that God is kind, you have to be kind. If you bring water to a guest, you are following in God's path you're performing an act of kindness. If you bring water to a guest, then you are fulfilling ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. You must love your fellow man as yourself. That's a strange command. You must love your fellow man as yourself. Listen, guys, I'll tell you something. You may be good, but there is no way that I'm going to love any of you as much as myself. That I could tell you. Right, I love myself. I am absolutely infatuated with myself. And I can say it because I know you are with yourself too. Right? If there's anybody that we're good to and there's anybody that we love, it's ourselves. How can the Torah tell me love my fellow man as myself? Right? I guess the Torah's telling me to control my emotion? All right, we have to work on our emotions, but there's a very practical way. The most practical way, how do you demonstrate you love somebody? You tell, take it from me, boys. Let's just turn this off for 1 second over here. You can leave that. We'll erase it after. When you tell your worth about this much, right? That's what it's worth, right? Do you know why? It depends. Well, first of all, it depends when you tell her that, right? If you tell her that, and then you go and you clean the floors in the house, and you do the dishes, and you take care of the kids, get an early night's sleep, and she could rest a little bit, then it's worth a whole lot, right? But if you say that to her because it's your night out with the boys, right? And after all, you can't wait to get out of the house and get out, hit the bar, do some drinking, leave her home and take care of the kids. And on your way out, you say, oh, really, Edna, I love you, right? And you take off because you figure that what you got to make, then it's worth that much, right? Because love is only worth as much as you demonstrate with your action. So the Torah says, v'ahavta l'recha, you must love your fellow man as yourself. Well, how do you think you're going to get to that point of even getting close to loving your fellow man? Obviously, by taking action, which is going to lead to love. And we know that definition, you've heard a million times. The definition of love is what you put into something, not what you take from it. Therefore, to give to somebody else, you're fulfilling the command of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. So everything you name will fall into one of those subcategories. Going to sleep at night and dedicating yourself to God. So we'll find a category in the mitzvahs of where you're dedicating yourself, where your entire focus in life is on God. Right? If nothing else, in the mitzvah in the Torah of loving God. You have to love God. Well, part of loving God is preparing yourself to serve God. Right? So it fits in that category. But it's only if you use sleep as a means to an end. If sleep becomes an ends in itself, which for many of us it is, right? Or if any physical pleasure becomes an ends in itself, then it's not serving God, then it's serving yourself. That's taking advantage of one of the pleasures God made available to us. Right? So that's everything you can name will fit into one of those categories. That's why all of the midos, any type of character traits, fit into that category, fit into ways of emulating God.
If I'm selfish, if I'm being selfish, that's a prohibition. I'm violating the prohibition of, there's a composite command of Torah that I'm meant to emulate God. God is not selfish. Right? So every if I get angry, right, I'm not emulating God. God doesn't get angry as we know anger. When I tableize that altar, we make sure to have salt on the table. Salt is your reminder that your table is supposed to be an altar, just as there was salt on the altar in the base of English, and the salt never left. That's A. B, we dip the bread in the salt. So we dip the bread three times in the salt, according to, it has nothing to do with the taste of the bread. This is also the same idea, that we have salt on the altar, we dip the bread in the salt, and there's a symbolism why we dip it three times. Three times, God's name multiplied by three equals a numerical value of melach, of salt. And melach and lechem are made up of the same, bread and salt are made up of the same letters. Lechem, melach, okay, yeah. Scott, did you want to?
Just the last bit. The second half of that question was, you say now three people sitting at a table, if they must speak a word of Torah if they're not to be considered having a meal only for its own purpose in the sense of an idolatrous meal.
Right.
Does that mean that sitting at a table, that having a meal with three people and not having a word of Torah is in a sense violating a mitzvah? Is that the answer there? Is that a mitzvah, or it falls under a category of mitzvah? So are we not doing a mitzvah? Is that an
avera? Is it an avera per se? It's probably not actively an avera as much as the neglect of the fulfillment of the mitzvah. Right? If you don't put on tefillin in the morning, the person doesn't put on tefillin in the morning, there are two types of commands. There are positive commands and negative commands. To not put on tefillin in the morning is not a negative command. To not put on tefillin, it's the neglect of a positive command. Right? There are two different types of commands in the Torah. To not speak a word of the Torah, if nothing else, to not speak a word of Torah day, but it's a neglect of the command to be immersed in Torah day and night. Meaning that any opportunity we have to be thinking about, speaking about, and focused on Torah, right? Without turning into neurotics. Right? That means you have to control your Torah, right? You have to control how your dedication. You could be very dedicated to Torah, but when you go home from yeshiva, you know, if your parents say to you, you know, your parents start talking, some people go to extremes. Your parents say, "Hi, how are you?" Bereshis bara Elohim es haShemayim, right? You don't speak, you know, all you do is quote verses and speak Aramaic, right? So that's not what the Torah wants from us. Well, one of the verses in the Torah is Drachei HaDarchei Noam. Its ways are ways of pleasantness, right? So if you alienate people through your Torah, right? So obviously you're not emulating God. God didn't alienate anybody with the Torah. So it all has to be controlled. On the other hand, a person, whenever possible, for each individual, subjective, this person has to be immersed in thinking about Torah.
But there's like the thing with I read this Midrash saying that the angel couldn't kill Sarah because she was always thinking about
Torah.
Torah.
Oh, very good.
So then, it'd be good.
Obviously, at her level, that's where she's holding. The Gemara says, the Talmud says the same thing about David HaMelech, right? Yeah, King David, the angel of death couldn't get at King David because King David was told by God that he was going to die on Shabbos. He begged God, "Tell me when I'm going to die." God said, "I'm not going to tell you when you're going to die." There are seven things, the Gemara says, that no man knows. Seven things are hidden from any man. Seven things that no man is given, God does not give this information to anybody. One of those things is what day he's going to die. It's interesting, the Gemara says, no man knows what his friend is thinking. The Gemara says, possibly because if we knew what our friends were thinking, we wouldn't have many friends. Right? But the Gemara says, no man knows what his friend is thinking. The Gemara says, no man knows what the embryo is in the mother's stomach. Obviously, without the help of medical equipment, right? Nobody knows. Even then, not foolproof. You know, there are cases when they examine it with the
ultrasound.
The ultrasound to determine the gender of the child, right? And I heard two very funny stories. Not so funny, but they're funny. One of them was somebody prepared for, the doctor said they're going to have a boy, so they prepared for Shalom Zachar. Shalom Zachar is a celebration when the child is born. You have a first Friday night of a male child being born, you have this little shindig, right? So somebody prepared for Shalom Zachar, and there's one hitch, right? The baby, the boy, was a girl, right? The ultrasound showed boy, and it turned out that it was a girl. Then I heard of one woman, the ultrasound told her it was going to be a girl, and when she gave birth, the doctor said to her, "Mazel tov, it's a boy." She said, "It can't be, the ultrasound said it's a girl." You know, there is, by the lady, look, you know, here it is. You know, there's a little, you know, the little nipper is a boy. So that's one of the things nobody knows. So one of the things that Warren says that nobody knows is the day of death. Why? Why does God keep that hidden from us? Because if we knew that our day of death, we would live things, live it up, right? And then, you know, a guy knows that, let's say January 1st in the year 2050, he's going to die, right? So you live it up a little bit. And then as you get a couple of weeks before that big day, right, they start doing shit. I got some, this information in advance. I may as well use that information to enjoy myself. Then 2 weeks in advance, we'll start getting serious about life, right? Therefore, God says, no, every day, like Pirkei Avot says, you have to view every day as if it's your last. Right, because if you live every view every day, you don't know when you're going to die. So every day has to be a day of tshuva because it may be a person's last. So that's one of the things that's hidden from every man. So King David was told by God, he asked God, tell me when I'm going to die. So God said, no, I can't tell anybody, but I'll tell you this much, it's going to be on Shabbos. You're going to die on Shabbos. So the Gemara says that every Shabbos, King David studied Torah from sunrise to sunset. Friday night, sundown Friday night till sundown Saturday night. He did nothing but study Torah, and then the day that he finally died, the angel of death came to get him. The angel of death had to make some type of commotion to distract him, and the instant he distracted him, the angel of death was able to get him. The Malach HaMavis was able to take David HaMelech Neshama.